Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of February 4th. This week we were joined by the Reverend J. Brian Hare of Harvard University and the Archdiocese of Boston. Father Hare delivered the annual John Courtney Murray Lecture, which was held on Monday, January 14th. This week we are happy to be joined by Father Brian Hare, who is the Montgomery Professor of the Practice of Religion and Public Life at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He is also the Secretary of Social Service and Healthcare for the Archdiocese of Boston. Welcome, Father Hare.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Now, Father Hare just gave a talk last night at Fordham University, sponsored by America, the John Courtney Murray Lecture on what John Courtney Murray did say, didn't say, and might have said about certain issues facing us today. Now, Father Hare, you focused on four issues. Maybe briefly you could lead us through those for people who were unable to talk last night.
Yes. For what I did was I took each issue and tried to give a snapshot of its present status. Then I looked back into Murray's writings and selected those things that I thought might be pertinent to each issue, even though Murray did not face some of these questions directly, and then I commented on them. So the four issues were the relationship of the church and the world, secondly, war and peace, thirdly, the question of abortion and the civil law in the United States, and fourthly, the religious freedom debate about the HHS mandate that's been going on over the past year, year and a half. So those were the four topics. And essentially, the reason I gave the title of what he did say, didn't say, and might have said is that on some of them, there are rather direct Murray resources that you can translate into the question of the problem today. At other times, he simply didn't comment at all because he didn't face certain questions. And then thirdly, a question like the HHS mandate, my question there is what advice might he have given on that question to how the church ought to engage it?
Why don't we start with the first two, church in the world, war and peace. Church in the world, is this something that he wrote about, commented on during his time?
Yes, actually. When I introduced the topic of the church in the world, I said we have both a topic that is as old as the church itself. Mm-hmm. The church in the world as a topic begins with the New Testament. Its classic statement is found in Augustine's City of God, but it has been a continuous question for the church. And the reason I chose it was it's not just a continuous topic, but Vatican II, of course, produced the document on the pastoral constitution on the church in the world, which is the contemporary statement of the church in the world. Now, Murray addressed the question of the church in the world at various times in his career. I noted last night, much to my surprise, as I did preparation for this talk, as far as I can tell, he was never consulted at Vatican II on the preparation of this document. Obviously, he was the primary person on the document on religious liberty, but he was never directly involved, insofar as I can tell, in the preparation of Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution. But my point last night was that at the end of his life in theological studies, Murray wrote a long article in which he took the document on religious liberty and the document on the church and the world and compared them and bound them together. And he gave us, out of that comparison, a framework for interpreting a contemporary vision of the church and the world. His particular contribution, I think, was to focus on the document on the church and the world, in which at the heart of that document, it's actually paragraphs 40 to 42, the church gives a kind of structural statement of how we should think of the church's public engagement. On the one hand, the document says the church is not a political institution. And what it means by that, I think, is the church has no particular political charism, no particular guarantee of the Holy Spirit's guidance when it makes political judgments, although it is free to make those judgments. Secondly, the council document says the church has a religious ministry, not a political ministry. the religious ministry is in the service of the kingdom. And so the framework of thinking about the church's engagement in the world is really how you relate the understanding of the kingdom, which Jesus preached all the time, to the life of the church and then to the life of the secular world. So the church is not a political community. It is a religious community in the service of the kingdom. But then thirdly, the key thing Vatican II said was that as the church pursues the work of the kingdom, it should do it in such a way that the church's own ministry contributes to four things: the protection of human rights, the promotion of human dignity, a sense of meaning to all areas of public affairs, and the promotion of the unity of the human family. So these four broad goals make up the framework, if you will, for the church's engagement with the world.
Now, on the subject of war and peace, you note that Murray actually didn't write that much about war.
No, but my point last night was the two things he wrote were quite distinctive and long-lasting in their impact. He wrote a piece in Theological Studies in 1959, which was republished in many places. That was a sign of how important it was. And in that document, what Murray does is to address the issue of war and peace as it stood in his day, namely the superpower conflict and the superpower conflict with the possibility of nuclear conflict emerging from it. My point was that Murray's essay in 1959 is not only pertinent to what he said on that question, but it's a kind of classical example of the just war ethic as it is held and stated in the Catholic community. So when you go to that essay, in a sense, the topics he wrote on have been changed with the collapse of the Cold War, but you can read that essay as providing you an understanding of the premises the church uses in order to develop the just war ethic. So then I went on from there to say that war in our time, the complexity of the world we live in, is on the one hand that the enormous danger of a cataclysmic nuclear engagement such as existed in the Cold War, the possibility of that is dramatically reduced. But we live in a world that produces three kinds of war: interstate war, the kind of war Murray did write about; secondly, internal war inside states, Syria, Libya, the Balkans, states in Africa, which raise the question of humanitarian intervention; and then thirdly, what I call transnational war, war conducted by non-state actors, and that is what we commonly associate with terrorism. Now, my point is, Murray wrote on interstate war. He did not write on the other two. I could easily see what he said adapted to what many of us have developed as a just intervention document, because his writings would have easily done that. What Murray would have said on transnational war and terror, I'm not sure of. It's one of those things where it's hard to figure out what he would have said.
Now we can move to the third topic, which is abortion, which is, I guess, Murray died before this became such a central issue.
Exactly right. Murray died 6 years before Roe v. Wade, so he never confronted the issue. However, the point I made last night is that he did write on the question of jurisprudence, which is essentially the relationship between one's understanding of the moral law and the understanding of how much of the moral law can and should be translated into positive civil law. So my point was that 40 years after the Supreme Court decisions, which of course were awful decisions, I quoted John Noonan last night, who said they were the worst decisions since the Dred Scott decision. But 40 years after that, if you look at how the abortion issue is debated, essentially you have to think about it at three levels: the moral level, what you think about abortion as right and wrong; the legal level, how much you think you should legislate about abortion, and then the political level, the fact that it comes up in every presidential election, that it's constantly being raised. I think it is constantly being raised at the political level because we've never gotten any satisfactory adjudication of the moral and the legal. So my point was that Murray wrote this article that we find in We Hold These Truths called Should There Be a Law, in which he laid out a kind of classical natural law framework of jurisprudence. His point was that the civil law ought to be rooted in the moral law. It ought to be grounded in the moral law. But the civil law had a much narrower focus than the moral law. Every human action, public, private, personal, social, thoughts, words, and deeds, are all covered by the moral law. Any of those actions can be judged by the moral law. But the civil law does not try to pass legislation on all of those things. The civil law, as Murray pointed out, only is used to govern by either prohibition or prescription those issues that have such a substantial impact on the common welfare, the common good, common welfare of the society. It's only then that the civil law comes into play. So the second thing Murray wrote that was pertinent to law and morality was that Cardinal Cushing in Boston in the early 1960s was faced with a decision where the Massachusetts legislature was going to repeal a Massachusetts law that prohibited the sale of contraception in Massachusetts. And he wrote Murray and asked for advice. Murray wrote him a really kind of an application of what he had written on jurisprudence in the other article. And he actually said to the cardinal that the way you think about these things is in two steps. You ask the question, is the issue at hand an issue of public morality, the kind of issue that impacts the public good, or is it private morality? Now, private morality is still moral. You have to make moral judgments, but you don't try to incorporate all of your vision of morality into civil law. You only deal with public morality. He argued that contraception was not a question of public morality and that the cardinal should not, that the cardinal could, in a sense, give support to the repeal of the law, which he did, and got an editorial in the New York Times congratulating him at the time. But my point was that that distinction between public and private morality is one of Murray's major points. His second major point is that when you're thinking about which issues are part of public morality, the category you need to use is, does the action involved impact the public order of society? Now, the term public order is in the Declaration on Religious Liberty. It is in the Declaration because it asks the question, can the state ever set any limits on the exercise of religious freedom? And the answer that the Declaration gives is the state only can limit the exercise of religious freedom if the action involved threatens or violates the public order of society. Public order of society involves three goods: public peace, public morality, and justice, the violation of the rights of others. So my point was, some people, not Murray, have tried to ask whether Murray's writings on jurisprudence and public and private morality could be used on the abortion question, and if so, how. And I argued that while Murray never addressed the issue, I think it is a very sound decision to say that clearly Murray supported the moral teaching of the church on abortion. And secondly, because abortion involves the taking of a human life, because it does that, it is a violation of public order, and therefore Murray would feel that this issue should be governed by civil law, and that the church's position of trying to oppose abortion through public law I think Murray would find to be a defensible and necessary position.
Now, the fourth topic you touched on is one that's been talked about a lot for the last year or so, religious freedom, obviously something that Murray was the expert on. What do you think he might have said about these debates we've been having, specifically about the mandate regarding HHS?
Well, my point is you have to look at the mandate question. You have to have a sense of how we got here. The time frame for understanding the mandate, therefore, runs from 2010 through 2013. So in December of 2010, the Affordable Care Act, the Health Care Reform Act, was passed. Now, that was a complicated issue in itself because the bishops of the United States had supported universal access to health care since 1919. So they clearly wanted to see that happen. The Bishops' Conference, however, felt that the way the argument on abortion coverage was in the law, they could not support the law. My point is the law itself did not guarantee that we would be in this horrible situation of the mandates that we are in. So that one could make an argument that you supported the Affordable Care Act, but that you oppose the mandates which create the present crisis. So how did we get here since 2010? Well, if you look at the Affordable Care Act, here are the component elements as I see them anyway. First of all, the individual mandate that everyone must have insurance or pay a penalty. The bishops would have no difficulty with that. Secondly, the employer mandate that employers must provide health care or pay a penalty. Again, that's necessary to accomplish the act. Thirdly, after the act was passed, the Institute of Medicine, which is a subdivision of the National Institutes of Health, produced a list of preventive care services that should be covered without any copays by those who have insurance. Now, preventive services don't pose a moral problem for the church. Indeed, it's a reasonable kind of thing. The fourth step begins to get more complicated. After the Institute of Medicine had submitted their list, what one is told from commentary in the press was there was a large argument within the administration about adding reproductive health care services to the preventive services. Now, that would be bound to raise questions for the church, but at the general level of public law in the country, most of those services would be supported. So even though why the church might have some difficulty with it, it probably wouldn't have been a major conflict. It was the next step that was the problem. And the next step was the administration, I think very foolishly, then said that they were going to require certain Catholic agencies or any religious agencies, certain Catholic agencies to provide these preventive reproductive health care services, contraception and various forms of contraception. They're going to require that they be provided inside Catholic institutions. Now, when they were questioned about that, they said, well, we have a religious exemption. Now, this is the key issue, I think. In a democracy, public policy and public law will be decided by majority vote or by decisions of the court. But in a religiously pluralistic democracy, exactly the kind of thing that Murray was concerned about, it is almost inevitable that certain public laws will run counter to the convictions of religious communities. So the classical example is conscientious objection that is called for by Mennonites and Quakers, even though the country, if it is threatened, will draft everyone. So exemptions are crucial in a religiously pluralistic democracy, because what an exemption says is the wider public law will go ahead and govern the country. But because of the specific religious doctrine or practice of a religious community, that community will be exempted from observing the law because, under the American understanding of religious freedom, religion is special and deserves protection. So when the administration basically said that we will exempt dioceses and parishes, but we will not exempt Catholic charities, Catholic healthcare institutions, and institutions of higher education, Catholic art. What that did was to invade the precinct of a religious community in its various services and created a huge crisis. My point is, the crisis is best understood as a case study in bad public policy, because the administration not only is invading a religious community and its affiliates, but it's taking on the religious community with the largest social service network and the largest nonprofit healthcare system in the country. And our institutions, healthcare, social service, and education, the way we think of those institutions is they are generated from within the church, but we think of them as bridge institutions to the wider society. So what we look to do, and this was very much in Murray's style, is to use Catholic institutions to collaborate with the state for the common good of the society. The exemption the administration used was an exemption that was first defined in California at the beginning of this century. And that exemption says, in order to qualify for an exemption, you have to be a recognized 501c3. You have to serve only your own people, basically. You have to employ only your own people. And you have to be involved in the teaching of the values and doctrine of the community. Now, we don't do that in our institutions. Our Catholic Charities institutions do not ask you if you're hungry and Catholic. They just ask you if you're hungry. And we employ and are proud in our institutions of employing people of many faiths and no faith. So the paradox of this narrow exemption is that Catholic Charities ends up not being Catholic. And that seems to be, on the face of it, just ridiculous. So how do you solve this? It is not a hard problem to solve, in my judgment. All we need, I think, I'm saying this at a political level, the lawyers would have to work on it, but all we need is for the administration to expand the exemption that covers most dioceses and have it cover social service, healthcare, and higher education. That would be the end of the debate, and I cannot understand why the administration doesn't find that to be a negotiable solution.
So that's where the issue stands now, but we want to thank you very much for your insight on all four of these issues, and we look forward, I think some of this will be reprinted in the magazine, so we look forward to that as well.
Thank you very much. I love doing a lecture in honor of Murray.